Hey, listen, can we stop?
What's the matter?
I gotta take a leak.
You should go too.
What are you, my mother? Don't you think I'm capable of determining my own time to go to the bathroom?
So, isn't now one of those times?
No.
You mean you don't feel a certain degree of urgent pressure on the inner wall of your bladder now, right at this moment?
No, I'm fine.
Well, wouldn't you feel more comfortable being fully relieved of any excess fluids that might be building up immediately now?
I gotta take a whiz.
Don't go away.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I am your host, Jason Bishop, and hey, what do you say, Sam?
Hey, my secret identity is a secret.
And Trish Coughlin.
Hey, everybody. I'm not going to give you any secrets today.
Oh, fine. Be that way. How about Jeff Omega?
Oh, don't you know that this is a Screaming Paul McCartney song? Woo!
I wish you could see my face.
All right, today we're going to talk about what a dick is for.
It's for peeing.
And we're going to talk about Spies Like Us from 1985. Yeah, you know, my kid brain thought this movie was a whole lot better than it was. It isn't. My adult brain is like, what the fuck were you on? Why did you like this movie? Probably because I liked Ghostbusters and I liked Dan Aykroyd. And I like the idea of Chevy Chase, but I don't think I really liked him outside of Saturday Night Live and Christmas Vacation. Has he really done a movie that's worth watching outside of that stuff?
So I've been watching through a lot of old Saturday Night Live, and we just finished Chevy Chase's tenure on there. He's pretty good. I'd say that European Vacation, or sorry, just the first Vacation, Christmas Vacation, they're both good, but Chevy Chase, while a handsome man in his heyday and funny in his own right, he kind of leans on a lot of the same shticks quite a lot. And it seems like he only has leaned on them more and more over the years. You just realize that how mean-spirited a lot of it was.
Yeah, combine Caddyshack Chevy Chase and any other Chevy Chase, and you've really just got Chevy Chase.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, he's made a career out of being a buffoon.
Well, I mean, his career building up to Saturday Night Live, he was the pratfall guy, but you can only do that for so long, right?
Yeah, I was actually surprised because for the bulk of Chevy Chase's career, he leaned quite a lot into slapstick. And I feel like this would have been a good movie for some slapstick type comedy, and it was completely absent. I mean, he even does some of that in all of his Vacation movies, which some of which came out in a similar time period to this. So there's no excuse.
Well, some of it is kind of slapstick, though. Like, I mean, there's the constant him and Dan Aykroyd, like, slapping each other's hands. Literal slapstick. In this movie as well.
Yeah, but the pratfalls and stuff that Chevy Chase was so well known for at this time were missing. Mm-hmm. And given how little action there is in what should be an action comedy, it felt really absent.
Yeah, I mean, if you watch any of his Vacation movies, I'd say at least 50% of the jokes are Chevy Chase in some sort of scenario in which something mildly dangerous happens in relation to his body. And yeah, none of that in this movie. And you'd think it would be a perfect fit for a spy movie.
Well, with the exception of Christmas Vacation, when he does the saucer thing and then it like explodes him down the hill. I don't care. Even as a kid, I'm like, that's freaking dangerous. I was literally very scared in that point in the movie.
Somebody should hire a stuntman. I'm sure.
I mean, the one that freaks me out with that movie the most is when he's on the ladder and then it's fully extended and it's leaning up against the house. And then the mechanism that's holding it gives out and the ladder slides all the way down. That's pretty scary.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could probably argue that the same kind of rule applies for Dan Aykroyd movies. Like, I watch this and I'm like going, Blues Brothers and Ghostbusters was a fluke, wasn't it?
And when you look at it, yeah, I mean, nothing but trouble, Coneheads.
Yeah.
He's better in his supporting roles. Like, Gross Point Blank, he was great.
Yes. And My Girl. Yes. I was really charmed by him in My Girl.
You know, when watching him on SNL, a lot of his best sketches in SNL are when he can lean into the stuff that's really strange and weird and a little bit more esoteric. Or when he's pretending to be somebody who's a TV salesman who's talking about crazy appliances. And yeah, it seems that that was one of his shticks before he was on SNL. And his father was a famous ghost hunter and wrote a lot of paranormal books and stuff. So I feel like whenever Dan Aykroyd can lean into writing things that are a little bit strange or otherworldly, is really when he shines. But for a lot more straight stuff, it's pretty hit or miss, I think, for me, unfortunately.
Yeah. With the exception of Julia Child, that is comic brilliance. I love that whole sketch. Oh no, I've cut the Dickens out of my hand.
I mean, I liked him in this movie. He was the highlight of the movie for me, the way he played his character. I think that was part of the problem, is his character was the only thing that was well-written in the movie, and everything else kind of fell apart around him.
I'd argue that one. I'd say Dan Aykroyd is likable because he's Dan Aykroyd, and he's easy to watch because he's Dan Aykroyd. I can't say he was written well in this movie, but he knew his character because he wrote the script.
And maybe that's what came across. But yeah, he just felt the most fleshed out of the characters, and certainly the best developed out of. And I'm not saying that it was great. I mean, it's still really not very well developed, but his just seemed the best developed of it out of the few characters that were in the movie, or the millions of characters.
I liked how it was sort of, there's moments where it's like he's out of his depth, but there's bits of his personality that come across where he's like stuff that he knows or stuff that he's experienced that really come in handy that they definitely couldn't have figured out by the tests that they were giving these people. Like, he has an aptitude that sort of kept Chevy Chase alive for this movie. Like, Chevy Chase would have been dead 10,000 times if it weren't for Dan Aykroyd.
Oh, for sure. And I just had a revelation. All he did was take Ray and make him a spy for Lee.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Well, you know, one thing I'm curious about with this whole movie is it originally was supposed to be a John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd vehicle. And it was inspired by the Bob Hope, Bing Crosby Road 2 movies, which, you know, are just like comedy duo misadventures. And I get the feeling that this movie was supposed to be like one of their big follow-ups to Blues Brothers, really playing off of Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi's chemistry and friendship that they had. And they're really going to try to make a go of doing movies together before he died. And then John Belushi dies and they have to rework it with Chevy Chase. And I feel like that probably impacted the movie quite a lot.
Well, yeah, I mean, Chevy, I don't really think he had chemistry with anybody, honestly. And they definitely were meant to be a pair, him and John Belushi. And you were dead on with the road movies. That's why Bob Hope made that cameo in the movie, was when he's golfing through the desert. That was his little nod to the fact that, yeah, it was meant to be one of the Road 2 movies. I guess Road to Russia in this case.
And I have to say, that's the one thing I've always kind of hated about that movie. That one cameo, just, I didn't like. I love Spies Like Us, but that moment has always pissed me off.
Well, that one, I love Bob Hope. So as far as I'm concerned, it's the only good part of the movie. But for as silly as the movie is, it starts driving into like Police Academy, Airplane territory. And it's a different type of humor that the movie doesn't do at any other moment. So yeah, I can see why you would hate it, because it's the wrong type of comedy in that moment, in that movie.
Yeah. It's weird though, because there's so many moments in this movie that if they like steered into it, it would be really good. Like the whole Doctors Without Borders bit where it's like, oh no, these are our allies, that it would have, there's so many aspects of this where if they just kind of really steered into it, it would have been more interesting and it wouldn't have just been like kind of a sketch that just went on for a bit longer.
Yeah, there was a lot of moments actually in this movie which felt like they were sketches that were kind of strung together with a plot that wasn't a comedy.
Yeah, the whole movie is just sketch after sketch after sketch. There's no real direction. I mean, the point of these characters, they've been sent on this decoy mission to distract the enemy from finding the real agents. Mm-hmm. And the whole operation is sketchy because it's an underground operation within the U.S. government. So even the president doesn't know this is happening. And they are wanting to launch a Russian missile so they can test out their anti-missile thing and say, hey, yeah, the Russians attacked us. And it gives them plausible deniability in starting a war, essentially.
Yeah.
And it is a stupid plot.
Well, you know what? Here's the weird thing. When I'm looking at this, I'm like, yeah, you know what? When you think it's like a stupid idea that somebody would actually do this. I don't know. If you give a psychopath some power, they probably would.
Oh, yeah. I
mean, there's nothing about the plot that seemed not realistic. Like, I feel like...
Well, it didn't feel realistic until the last 4 years. Now, I mean, in 1985, it seemed like... There's no way this would have happened.
There's a lot of shady stuff going on in the 80s that's true.
Yeah. Reaganism.
Finding out about now.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Reaganism actually came back at the end of this movie. I was thinking, you know what? I don't know how I kind of missed this as a kid. I'm like going, I kind of really truly believe that the miss was on purpose. I don't even think they were trying.
Well, yeah, with General Sline there. Yeah, no, I think he intended to miss because he had a contingency plan to start a war regardless.
And he was like, yeah, I'd kill everybody to preserve the American way of life. And I can see that somebody would be like, oh, well, it's getting too lovey-dovey in America, so I've got to destroy everything. I could see somebody like that thinking that way.
Yeah, in the mid-80s, you're looking near the end of the Cold War, and the thought of nuclear annihilation was very real. That paranoia was kind of inherent within that time frame. This movie was originally scripted with that dark ending of it ended the world.
Yeah. Did you guys, I know Sam, Jeff, you're a bit younger than us, but like Sam and Jason, I know when I was a kid, yeah, nuclear war was one of my really huge fears when I was a kid, kind of in bed when I thought about it. I don't know if you guys ever felt the same way.
I don't know if I felt fear, but I was certainly aware of that possibility.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
I never felt... like afraid unless something really bad happened in a region and was starting to really hit the news. Most of the time, yeah, I didn't think about it too terribly much, but there would be something that would heighten the paranoia a little bit. I remember, what was that? There was a TV movie. I think it was called The Day After Tomorrow.
Yes.
About the nuclear strike.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that was scarier than any horror movie I ever saw.
And then there was another one I saw where somebody, it was like a documentary they did on Nostradamus where they talked about there was somebody from a blue turban would start World War III. That one freaked me the fuck out.
Yeah, the Nostradamus predictions were always pretty fucking freaky.
Yes.
Especially because everyone's just like, he predicted that a man named Hister would rise out of Germany and try to take over the world.
Yeah.
So they were like, oh my God, he was right about that. He must be right about this too.
But when you're 10... that does make sense.
Yeah, when you're 10, you just believe what's put in front of you, right? You know, you can easily look at a prophecy after something has happened and say, hey, he predicted it, and manipulate those words into what you want it to believe. Whether it was or wasn't, doesn't really matter. But
no.
Unless you can start using those predictions to stop shit.
Right?
Yeah, there was somebody who said of Nostradamus a while ago that prophecy is only prophecy if you can be proactive about it. And most people who are considered prophets, it's only in hindsight that people look back. But that's not prophecy. It's more...
It's a good guess.
Yeah. Well, it's not even a good guess if you only realize it after the fact.
No, but the person made a good guess and now you think they're a prophet.
Prophecy only exists in hindsight, my friends.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think that in a large way, spies like us, I feel like the whole movie was trying to be a lot more satirical and a lot more, I guess, biting about its satire of the American government. And I have a feeling that they maybe had to pull back on some of that or for whatever reason. But it would have been a better movie if they kind of went more for like the criticism of the government and the institution and the Cold War that I feel like they were trying to go for.
You know, I'm not sure if they were trying to go for that. They were literally watching Reagan in one of his old movies and stuff. I think this was a very Republican supported movie.
Really?
So I don't think they wanted to criticize the government. Everything was being done behind the government's back.
Oh, see, there's a whole point. The whole ending to me kind of undoes that, where it's them and the Russians working to save everybody. And that would be a not very Republican thing to say.
No, well, that was a very positive ending after the fact that they were going, they had originally shot an ending with the end of the world. Anyway, let's get to the trailer here and we'll be right back. Spies Like Us.
Spies Like Us. Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd.
We've got a very special assignment for you two.
Boy.
Heads down!
This is my sister. You can all have her.
You want a coffee? That's a good idea.
See that?
Hey, come on.
Honestly, you two were unbelievable.
Stop it!
Every minute you don't tell us why you're here, I cut off a finger.
Mine or yours?
Yours.
Damn!
Joe!
Hi-o, Silver! Away!
Chevy Chase.
Get us the hell out of here!
Dan Aykroyd.
To think my high school guidance counselor said I'd never amount to anything.
Spies Like Us.
We're Americans!
All right, that was a trailer for Spies Like Us, 1985, directed by John Landis, who we've talked about before, first time in episode 26.
Oscar, I wasn't there for that.
In episode 68.
I was there for this one. This was Trading Places.
That's right. This was actually based on a story and screenplay by Dan Aykroyd with, I noticed during the movie, he wasn't credited for story, but Dave Thomas, Canadian Treasure. And yep. We've talked about Dave Thomas in episode 121.
Strange Brew.
And he also,
ooh, hoser.
And he also made an appearance in episode 232.
I didn't pay attention to that one.
That was Rat Race. Everybody's in Rat Race.
Oh, yeah.
Or the other one.
When in doubt, guess Rat Race.
The screenplay was also written by Lowell Gantz and Balu Mandel, who were responsible for things like Splash, Parenthood, City Slickers, lots of good comedies, 80s comedies within their resume at that time. But considering there's four people involved in this, you would have thought it would have been a whole lot better than it was. Despite the fact that it was a very successful movie, this was actually Chevy Chase's most successful movie for the mid-80s. And the only one that didn't get a sequel. Go figure. Probably because everybody realized we got away with it. Let's not try to do this again.
Right.
Or Dan Aykroyd just didn't want to work with him again.
Maybe. Maybe. Possibly. I mean, there was lots of rumors about that with Chevy Chase. So.
Yeah.
That
he
has
been... He's been noted as notoriously hard to work with.
Every project he works on, he leaves with people saying, man, that guy was hard to work with.
Yeah. Well, you got to be careful of Dan Aykroyd, too. You don't want to ever bring that guy a script because next thing you know, it's made and your name's not on it. Allegedly. The stars, of course, Chevy Chase, who we just talked about, is Emmett Fitzhugh. And I think Sam said we'd never talked about him before, but that is not true.
You're right. I did catch one. We didn't really talk about him, but he was in an episode that we, about a movie that we did.
Yes. And that was in episode 178.
One that keeps coming back, Last Action Hero.
That's right. And Dan Aykroyd was Austin Milbarge. And of course, we talked about him in episode 50.
Ghostbusters.
And episode 68, which was Trading Places. Also stars Bruce Davidson as Mr. Ruby, who was in X-Men and X2. William Prince was Mr. Keys. We may have talked about him in episode 75.
Oh, he was definitely in Network.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Steve Forrest was General Sline, and he'd be famous for some of the 60s and 70s shows like Gunsmoke and SWAT. Tom Hatton was General Meigs. He was in Hogan's Heroes. Bernie Casey was Colonel Rhombus. And we may have mentioned him in episode 34, where he was in a much better spy movie.
Never Say Never Again.
That's right. There's a character called Jumpmaster. I don't know who he was or whatever. I guess he was in the plane. Christopher Malcolm, who actually has appeared in a couple of our episodes. Episodes 123, Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, and episode 129, Highlander. And oh my god, there are so many cameos that tie back to episodes. I'm not going to go through them all. I'm just going to name some names, and you can go find them in our back catalog as much as you want, or if Sam's really fast, he can throw them in there. Matt Frewer was in this movie. If you catch him blinking, you'll miss him, because I did. But I love Matt Frewer.
Me too.
Frank Oz, Terry Gilliam, Bob Hope, Vanessa Angels, Svetlana Plotnikova, Larry Cohen, B.B. King, Michael Apted, Sam Raimi, both of the Coen brothers actually were in this movie, Larry and Joe, and Ray Harryhausen.
Yes.
And of course, we got to mention Donna Dixon, because she's actually Dan Aykroyd's wife and one of the stars in this movie as Karen Boyer, who somewhere how got buried in the middle of all these cameo people.
Yeah, it's one thing with John Landis movies is he sure loves his cameos, especially considering if this was supposed to follow up Blues Brothers, the movie also had a lot of cameos.
That's actually one of his signatures, is throwing in pretty much all of his friends, and they only matter if you know what a director looks like. Otherwise, you're probably never going to catch it.
You know, I'll never complain seeing Sam Raimi in a movie.
I will this time because I didn't see him. But I mean, everybody's way younger, so I didn't recognize him when I saw him. I should say there was a couple where it was like, oh, yes, that is a very young so-and-so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're all blink and you miss them. They're basically all walk-ons.
I did catch Terry Gilliam because he had lines.
Yes.
So did Sam Raimi.
He was the guy at the drive-in, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. With Joel Coen.
Oh, okay.
What you have with John Landis is sort of the other edge of Chevy Chase, where people will come back and work with him because they want to.
Yeah. No, John Landis has a very good reputation.
Like, I'm kind of surprised by this movie a little bit, just because like John Landis has such an incredible catalog of movies. This one's kind of soft compared to some of his other comedies even.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if he was like just a hired gun director and how much he actually had to say in this, considering your story guy and your star are Dan Aykroyd. So how much say did Dan Aykroyd have in this? He was probably a producer as well, so his money on the line. So I'm not sure if Landis got to do as much as he would have liked to have done on a movie normally.
And, you know, interestingly enough, looking at the chronology of his movies, John Landis worked a lot with Dan Aykroyd, obviously doing Blues Brothers, following that up with Trading Places. But from what I can see, Spies Like Us was the last movie he did with Dan Aykroyd. And the next movie John Landis did have Chevy Chase in it, which was Three Amigos. So not sure really what happened there that he stopped working with Dan Aykroyd after Spies Like Us.
Well,
that's an interesting observation.
Yeah, like I said, Dan Aykroyd's got his own reputation inside the industry that isn't as well known outside of it.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it was Landis came back for Three Amigos because he's like, okay, maybe with Martin Short and Steve Martin, they can keep him in check. Because, I don't know, those two were probably really good at like stealing focus, and they would probably take the ire of Chevy Chase and leave the director to do his shit.
Right.
Because they know how to handle it, those two.
Was there any good bits you liked in this movie?
You know, my favorite bit was the introduction of Dan Aykroyd's character, where he's working as the repair guy. He's also a code breaker, and he's talking about how he broke a Chinese encoded code with a cereal box decoder. Like, that whole bit, that was pretty funny.
That was pretty witty. And the end bit where he's using Chevy Chase as a conduit, I actually enjoyed that. I just like the idea of Chevy Chase being electrocuted.
And to me, the visual joke of them all dressed up in all those big furry outfits, I don't know why I love it. I just love it.
They're playing at aliens is a bit ridiculous, but by that point you've already given up in your brain. So those big coats were pretty amusing because they could barely move in them.
Yeah, and like when he puts up his hands, it looks like his arms are like super short.
Yeah. And there is one moment, it's not a funny bit, but I do want to point out, and I've never caught this before because I've only ever seen this movie twice, the first time I saw it and this time, but the scene where they're like, the end of the world's coming and they're all going to make love. And yeah. It's very forward because there's like the two Russian men who like look at each other and go,
yes,
it's like, we're going to like address this sexual tension between the two of us now, finally. And I liked that. I really did enjoy that.
Yeah, that's like super progressive.
Give me a chuckle.
Yeah, well, just before that, when that all happens, like, oh, we ended the world. Let's go fuck.
Well,
like, that was my note.
What are you going to do? You can't undo it.
But they did undo it.
I know, but like at that point, you don't.
Let's go get laid before we actually use some thought. Considering that all happens with, they only had about 15 minutes and they still had time to spare.
40 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Was it 40 minutes?
40 minutes. And Dan Aykroyd's character even says, well, that was a nice 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And the intimacy that he had with that Russian soldier is what sets up his solution for the problem. So it did make sense. It was actually probably the tightest bit of writing because it actually does set it up. It gives him the idea as to how he could reset things.
And honestly, I mean, you've just done probably the hugest thing of all time. And your brain, like whenever you're faced with some horrible idea, sometimes you can't think as clearly as you normally would if you weren't a little bit more relaxed or detached from it for a few minutes.
Yeah. And the big question is what would you do if you had the opportunity, if you knew the world was going to be ending or you thought the world was going to be ending because of something you had done?
Right.
Run around screaming?
No.
No, you'd look for human contact.
Yeah.
Right. It actually does make a certain amount of sense. I mean, I think the fact that it's set up by Chevy Chase's character, who is established as a lech at the get-go, which was really poorly handled just all the way through the whole film. But regardless, he's set up as a lech who's always looking for the next woman to sleep with. It made sense for his character to go, well, this is the way I want to go out. I want to go out doing my favorite thing.
Yeah.
That was probably Chevy Chase's addition to the character, I'd imagine.
Absolutely.
That's like a through line through like every character he plays is he's always the person lusting after women because he was like a huge ladies man back in the day.
Oh, speaking of what parts you found funny in this movie, I do genuinely laugh every time he comes up. He's like, wait, you have a tent? I don't know why.
That was pretty funny. I actually like the we're in the Jeep and they have to pull over and Dan Aykroyd is like, you need to pee.
Yes.
That bit for some reason always makes me chuckle. And I kind of like the Russians that just appear out of nowhere all the time, but they're unfortunately inconsistent of it because they wind up getting away from the Russians who can't get ahead of them. Before they were moving like they were fucking Jason Voorhees. They're always in front of you.
Yeah.
And then right at the end, they lose their magical powers.
Like, I kind of wished that they were in it a little more, as a little bit more of like an antagonist against mm-hmm. them, because they were really great. Yeah, when they just appeared right in front of them after they were walking away from the car, and he's like, oh, well, you know what they say. And he speaks in Russian, they all laugh.
Yeah.
Give me a chuckle.
And they really sell, if they were in it more, it would really sell the whole idea. They're like, oh, great, the decoys are totally freaking working. Like, I would like that idea to be like, yeah, it's totally working. And they don't know that they're just decoys.
I love how the Russian decoy agents or the Russian undercover agents also are dressed like California preppies.
Yeah.
In the middle of the desert.
Yeah. Because
trying hard to look like Americans. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
With the Russian wristwatch. It's a good thing that guy who's a watch collector.
Yeah. See, that was the other aspect of his character I liked, where it's like you just... His hobbies come in handy. You just didn't know it at the time.
Yeah, and that's where I kind of got the whole idea of Ray being sort of like just transferred to as a spy rather than a mm-hmm. Ghostbuster, but because that's Ray's character, right? Mm. He just sort of knows a whole bunch of little things about a lot of stuff.
Yeah, no, he mm-hmm. was. I mean, they're interchangeable. He was just that lovable nerd character. It worked for him before. He was just trying to move it into a different genre. When I watched this movie the first time, I was really hoping it would be more of a comedic send-off of like a James Bond movie, which is kind of how I imagine this. I'm like, I watched this movie going, oh man, this is going to be tough to remake because what do you grab onto?
Yeah, and really it's the decoy agents is all you really have to grab onto.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah.
I mean, I like the idea that the enemy is within the U.S., and they are trying to start a war. I feel like that story still works and might be even more powerful. Like, what if it was corporately driven? Because war creates jobs, war creates money, war is business.
Yes.
I want it to be on.
Happened.
Yeah. I want it to be on purpose. I don't want it to be like, oh yeah, we're going to stop a missile. No, I want them to be like, we definitively want to do this.
It's almost like you could subtly rework the plot where they basically, instead of having these agents as decoys, they basically send them out to do an impossible mission to give themselves deniability about just engineering it entirely. And the US government is just behind the whole thing the whole time. But they don't expect the two spies they send off to actually succeed in stopping an impossible mission.
Yeah, I don't want the. I think Jay's on the right track. It's not the government. It's corporate, right? It's greed that's driving it rather than patriotism, because that's more in tune with the way things are now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, corporations manipulating the government into war. Yes. So, I mean, it's still a very politically driven thing, but they're trying to drive them into war for contracts. And that's where your story is. So, I mean we can still have that political. Exactly. So that's what we kind of grab onto here. Maybe less of the bits of them writing a test and getting, I don't know how we, maybe they are already agents that they weren't using and they're stuck in the office, but the way they set it up, it's like, okay, they've written a test. We see the cheating. Like they are in high school. I swear to God, they just pulled that from another movie. It feels like it.
What I want, what I can see is like they both already work for the government. So what you could have is people like they've been applying to be field agents and they've just always gotten passed over because they didn't think they had what it took. So like their HR files are there. And they're like, these two are pretty disposable. Like I think they would have that information.
Yeah, I was thinking that you'd have like sort of one of them is like really good at the physical aspects. He's good at the fighting and the gunplay and all the stuff that you sort of physically need to be able to do as a spy, but he's not very bright. Mm-hmm. And then the other one's super bright, but not so good at the physical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that sort of contrast. Very much the 21 Jump Street remake movies, which I didn't enjoy, but that dynamic mm-hmm. I think would work really well in a film like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's kind of something I was thinking of as well. Like we're going to get into casting, but this is a movie where I feel like for a large part of what I was thinking of in terms of a remake is we don't really have a lot of good comedic duos who are in their 30s today. Like the last really good wave of comedic duos we had for a movie like this were really in the 2000s, and they're all in their like late 40s, early 50s now, other than the people who did Broad City and some other stuff. But
Broad City and Community, like Troy and Abed.
I think our trick here is, well, at least with our casting, and we'll find out a little bit later, is trying to find some pairings of our own to put together and hoping there'll be chemistry. And that was kind of what they were hoping for here, that SNL chemistry would carry over. Unfortunately, it didn't. But I think that's what they were hoping for. But now we need to have a little more cohesiveness with the story itself. Like part of what using these guys is okay if it doesn't wind up being a suicide mission for them, which they wouldn't know, they're also good as patsies.
Yes.
So they have somebody to blame if something goes wrong, and plausible deniability on multiple levels with these guys.
Yeah. And I do want to mention this movie has already kind of been remade and remade well in Spy with Melissa McCarthy.
Yeah, they did it really well with Spy.
Yeah.
That was part of what I was thinking too. I'm like, we kind of have to dance around this a little bit because there are better comedy spy movies. Oh, do we use Russians still? Or do we use North Korea? Or do we use the Chinese? Do we make up our own villain? Or, do we make up our own villain, some make-believe country? I always find these work best with wherever the most tension happens to be, though.
I feel like you could probably play into some modern political tensions that we have, but not play with anything that is 100% real by making it be like a new fringe white supremacist group from Germany, like people who are trying to start the Third Reich again and have kind of Nazis as your villains, because
we have
that
those
kind
now.
Of strike a little close to home. Well, yeah. But it's not like it's not like North Korea or China, where there's like some possible real world tensions with another country. But we do have groups like that in Germany, and we do have supporters of groups in America.
I mean, we could just keep it, because like Russians as a villain is still a big deal. We could keep the setting in the 80s and then pull from some of those Bond-esque spy tropes as well. But it's like little gizmos that like Milbarge creates on his own. Milbarge can double his Q in the field.
Yeah. Yeah, like part of his thing is he maybe he works in R&D beforehand, and all of the gadgets that he makes are like cool but largely impractical.
Yeah.
And he doesn't ever get his stuff out in the field with the real agents, but when he goes in as a field agent, he gets a chance to use his impractical gizmos.
Yeah.
So that would be a funny bit. And I was just thinking, like, what if, because we're kind of leaning more towards the sort of the corporate interference and the military industrial complex, what if they're going after a country that's competing with them on a military development level rather than an actual threat to the country, like Japan or China would work in that aspect as well, because they do have a big military industrial complex. But something like that, rather than going against a country or a specific demographic.
We learned pretty quickly when we did the Red Dawn episode that they don't want to ever point the finger at the Chinese, because then your movie doesn't run there.
Yes. Right. Well, that's why I was thinking Japan might be a good sort of, because they're actually an innocent party in the whole thing. And I kind of like the idea of them like sort of instigating a war with a country that doesn't really deserve that.
Well, and
attention.
You can have that whole thing where it is the corporations and it's really just like kind of ads and social, like, I mean, we're sending it back in the 80s, but I mean, honestly, you could spread that misinformation still then as well.
Problem is Japan doesn't develop weapons in that regard there, but they're very much a business hub. But then you have to change the plot into something else, because it's really hard to start World War III with a country that doesn't have that technology or isn't allowed to develop it, because that's part of the reparations from World War II, right?
Or could France even, right? I mean, because everybody hates the French, so
I don't.
It was a joke, Jay.
They Trish make my it. Favorite potato.
French fries.
Hey, you know what? Just as a complete aside, I found out that French fries are called French fries because of the Julienne style of cutting vegetables.
Oh.
Yeah. There's a little tidbit for you.
But yeah, like just as an example, rather than make it entirely political, like, I mean, it has political motivation, but it's less about government and more about profit.
Well, if you're thinking about it, like, you can really tie in to Austin, Dan Aykroyd's character, being very technologically adept, because you could have maybe Japan isn't like making the weaponry, but they're making the guidance systems.
They're making the chips and the technology.
They're making the chips and the technology.
Right.
And they want the monopoly on it. So.
Yeah. And I mean, I see like sort of corporate America going, you know what? We need to create a new enemy so that we can create a new market for our products. So I could see them sort of like trying to create a new enemy.
Mm-hmm.
That could be interesting, where we could have like some comedy bits where they are actually creating televised propaganda for that very thing. I mean, we've got entire news networks that do that. So it wouldn't be too far from it, reality, by doing advertising or even we could have our own fake network in the movie.
Do it's kind of like Paul Verhoeven kind of throws in as like his little bits.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which I always find really enjoyable, because they really do sort of set up the culture that he's trying to show you.
Yeah, they do a good job of like painting the background of your world, right?
Yeah. As we've learned over the many years we've been alive, is there's honestly nothing really enforcing some of these networks to actually tell the truth. So you don't have to.
Yeah, I mean, everything we're talking about is just stuff that exists already.
Now, okay, right? We've kind of got the instigation. What's the solution? What is the end game for our characters? How do they solve the problem?
Yeah. I mean, if you're gonna go in the direction of going against another country that manufactures guidance systems or something, you could have it be somewhat like sabotage type mission, where they're going to intentionally sabotage guidance chips that another country is producing, so America can turn around and say, this is why we don't outsource, this is why we buy American, in order to boost industry in America, if that's the direction we're going.
So the job with the spies is to create an accident.
Yeah.
So the decoys, what would their job be told? Because they wouldn't be told that.
No.
They'd probably be very against doing something like that.
No,
which also puts them at odds with the opposing spies, rather than becoming allies at the end.
Well, what you can do is you can have it where, he puts in something that means that like the U.S. will have control of the guidance systems. That's their end game, because they're like, well, we don't want this foreign government to like have complete control. So what we need to do is go in there and do the chip. And then the government launches something on purpose or screw something up or destroy something.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could be, I mean, it would depend on.
Because then they're not doing anything bad.
Manufactured for.
They think they're helping the U.S. They're not literally trying to cause an accident. But what they find out is that their government has legit been planning to make an accident happen.
Or this corporation behind their government's back, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, we talked about setting it back in the 80s, but what if we do keep it modern or even move it further into the future, where it's almost like a science fiction type thing?
You know what? Here's
where they're using that too.
Here's the other thing. I don't think it's the corporations behind the government's back. Here's the other part of it. I believe that there's going to be a bunch of the government people, the military people are like going, if we have this accident, we get more money. They cannot be in the dark. I don't think they would be. I think they would be like, no, we get a lot more money from the government to buy a lot of more of your shit. And we can play with all of our toys for as long as we want.
Like governments, they are largely controlled by corporations anyway.
And largely controlled by the defense budget.
They'd have to gather enough actual evidence to present to the world that's undeniable to shut this down properly, to make sure this corporation is taken down by the government and the military for trying to start something like basically treason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, but I'd say it's not so much the government, but definitely the military is involved. They know about it. I don't want them to be, we're going to take down this corporation, because they're part of it. I know they are. I don't feel that's realistic.
Okay. Well, we are making a fucking comedy here, so it's dial it back a little bit.
Well,
I know.
Like,
but some of the best comedy is realistic. It really is.
Well, I mean, especially to try to keep in spirit with the original one where, like, I do feel like a lot of the plot was not like necessarily that out of the realm of possibility. And all of that stuff was treated with a fair amount of seriousness, regardless of how silly it ended up being. And I mean, you know, it has to be believable.
No, and I could see like a general or like even the director of defense going sort of behind the president's back to create something, because he has been cutting budgets and there's nobody for them to sort of fight. I mean, I could see there could be some opportunity for humor there, but yeah, I mean, we're talking sort of grand scheme, not just, I mean, it's corporate driven, but there's a partnership between somebody in the military defense compound for sure.
Yeah, like the whole thing being like there's a company that's trying to get a military contract, and the company that is already filling it is who they want to take down so they can get the contract, because somebody involved in the government has a stake in the company that's trying to get it. So they're just trying to take down another military contractor for munitions or something. But I guess my main question is, though, is if it was going to be sabotage, it's almost like they could try to set up the decoys as double agents in case they fail. And then they would say, hey, they're trying to sabotage this for the other side. Yeah. So our weapons would fail.
Yeah. What if Bill Barge, he creates some sort of gizmo that stops whatever this is happening, but also puts him, because all of his creations for the government at this point were so crazy and impractical that he got shoved in the closet and fixing toasters or whatever. So we could have it so one of his gizmos does work, and it puts him in a position where he winds up becoming rich off of this idea. He becomes now suddenly the most important guy to the government, because now he's become, all of his ideas have relevance because he had that one thing that saved the planet.
You know, and it could be too he's a guy where he's an R&D for the government, but a lot of his inventions are things that are not plausible for the capitalist agenda, because they make things like, some of them would erase parts of industry. It's like, oh, I could find a way to put this thing in a missile, so instead of blowing up it makes things rain or something, so we could solve drought. Like, that's a dumb example, but you know, stuff like that, where there could be companies who have an invested interest in not having that be
But Jeff, we want dumb examples, because these are the things that government passes on, right?
Sure.
It's a great idea that they don't see anything in. So
it's like that car that runs on water thing.
Yeah.
Where it's like, he doesn't know why he's always being shafted with his ideas. Some of them are dumb, but some of them are like genuinely brilliant.
Yeah. And some of his stuff, what he makes, he's like, oh yeah, no, this whole thing is, it's going to last. It's going to run for 50 years and it's awesome. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, no, but then people won't keep buying it and replacing it.
And it costs like 50 cents to make versus $5 million to make. There's the, that aspect of it as well. There's no profit in it.
Yeah.
I like that. That gives us our happy ending where this guy becomes the new corporate guy, but he's genuinely out to make the world a better place, which is something the government didn't want, but it's become so public now that they have no choice but to back him, you know.
Yes, you could have something where, like, he's like a good-natured guy who just wants to make the world a better place, and they're being set up to fail from the get-go, but because he has like this voice inside of him of like, oh well, but I could do this and it would be better, they end up accomplishing something super big. And it's so good that the government has to take credit for it.
Mm-hmm. He's always got the best of intentions, very good natured. I kind of like that. And his partner's going to be the more gruff guy with confidence. I'd say he would be like the guy who wants to be the super spy, but really sucks at it. Yeah, no critical thinking whatsoever. He wants to be James Bond, wants to get laid by all the ladies who just like, it's, hey, it is the 21st century. They're like, talk to the hand, you sexist pig.
Yeah.
Yep.
That'd be fun to play on that joke because of the character in the original. So you sort of turn that on its ear. I like that idea.
I really liked, it was a small character detail in the first one where like he only got the job because his dad was in the military. And like he's not really qualified at all to be there, but he's basically there because of nepotism.
When you're talking about like Dan Aykroyd's character with the good naturedness and stuff, part of the reason they want to set him up as a patsy is because he has all these good ideas that could legitimately make the world a better place and cost them money.
Yeah, get rid of the problem.
Yep.
And make that subterfuge useful in another way as well. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like he was pretty concerned about money, the character in the original one. And you could put him in a situation where maybe he doesn't necessarily want to be a field agent, but he's going to get a huge pay raise and like he needs the money. So he's like, well, you know, great. It's like not what he wants to set out to do, but, you know, money talks.
Well, they could just use it as a way to say, well, if you can get this done, we can get you into R&D, which is where you want to be. Mm-hmm. Right. So they use it as sort of a carrot, right, to get him where he wants to go.
Oh, yeah. Like it could be sort of like a promotion thing. Like you have to have some field experience before we'll put you into R&D or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. And he could be like fiddling at home making this stuff too. So he's putting all of his money into his experimentation. And so it could be money motivated too. But if he can get promoted to where he wants to be, lots of good motivation there as well. Okay. So I think we got this kind of rounded out a little bit more. And we've kind of steered away from the bits of like, oh, cheating on the test and they become test dummies, which should have been funny, but wasn't. I don't know why it didn't work, but it didn't.
The funniest part about that was when they were playing back the camera footage of them that they were watching. I think that, for some reason, was filmed in a funnier way than the actual scene itself.
And maybe that's what they should have done instead of having that whole embarrassing scene play out for you. We could have just had that shown back to them. It did the same thing, and you could have cut out all this extra stuff, this extraneous stuff out of the film and added it elsewhere.
Definitely.
I'm not sure about like how the Doctors and Borders fits in, and like they just seem to be dropped into situation after situation in this particular movie, which may be in keeping with the road movies. I don't know. I never really watched any of those.
Yeah, it was just an easy way to introduce the other pair of agents, really.
Yes.
And that's all it was there for.
Yeah. Which we could do that more logically within the body of the story rather than something that doesn't really matter. Let's operate on this warlord and have him die on the table. I'm like, none of that forwarded the story. Most of the movie didn't forward the story. The story didn't really take off until the last half hour.
Yeah. You know what? You can make it. It just occurred to me because we've got such like a good natured guy who's like really good with gadgets. You could have something similar to that, but rather than them having to run from these people, like he comes up with something where he's like, oh no, this heart valve isn't going to work. And he fixes it and they're able to like fix it in the con. And there's an actual doctor who can do the surgery. And then these guys, the whole tribe kind of helps them get across the border. Like it doesn't have to be a big chase scene. It's like, he's legitimately like they're lucking into getting people to helping them.
I like that idea better, actually. That I think that works better for their characters and even for the story. There's an actual doctor there who's trying to save him, but can't figure out exactly what's going wrong or why it's not working. And he figures it out.
And there can be, and there can be a great line where these guys are like, I thought they were supposed to be decoys. We didn't expect people to fucking like them. And they just keep getting helped.
Yeah. We didn't expect them to be good at what they do.
No, they're not. Just everybody keeps pushing them forward.
But I think that's the
point. But in ours, they do.
They are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because like the whole conceit of the story is that like they're supposed to be terrible at what they do, but because of their unique experiences in life, they're weirdly suited to only the scenarios that they're in against all odds.
Yeah, and I think maybe thrusting these two people together who are kind of office jokes, they've inadvertently created a good team.
Exactly. Yes. That's what I was going to say, is they only work when they're together, because you have the counterbalance, the one's the physicality and the one's the intelligence. And between the two of them, they're one really great agent.
Yeah. It's like the armless man and the legless man teaming up to be a perfect soldier kind of thing.
Yes.
Okay, well,
But, you know, you could also have something, too, with the Chevy Chase character, where, because we talked about him kind of being the more James Bondy character, but not being great at it. You could have a thing where he's like obsessed with spy movies and he wants to be a spy like in the movies. So like what he brings to the table is he's just, you know, he's seen every spy movie and can weirdly apply unrealistic spy movie tropes to situations they're in to get out of trouble in some instances.
Maybe that's actually where he can like, okay, I need this gadget. Can you make that happen? Like now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Chevy,
I need my jacket to explode.
Character doesn't really yet. Yeah.
If I just had a laser watch. Oh, I have one of those.
Yeah. It's like, oh, wait, I have a laser pointer and a watch. I can do both of those things.
Because Chevy Chase's character doesn't really bring anything to the table.
No.
And I feel like bringing something to the table would make it a better dynamic.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's why I was sort of complimenting each other in their strengths. It just makes the dynamic work better and makes it make more sense, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you want to feel like your characters are contributing to the story when, yeah, you watch the original and clearly Chevy Chase isn't really. Can't say even Donna Dixon does much. You know, her partner dies right away. She gives an okay speech, a ludicrous speech that seems to get Chevy Chase kind of horny. I do find it interesting that Dan Aykroyd basically loaned out his wife to Chevy Chase. Not literally.
Yeah. Well, basically, she was kind of good at her job because she knew neither she nor Hadley could do that surgery. So her job was to go in and try and seduce him into doing the surgery. She knew what she was doing most of the time. So she just wasn't very well written and underwritten and underutilized.
Yeah, it's fairly telegraphed that she's one of the agents, but at least it seemed that way to me, but I guess I've also seen this a few times.
Yeah.
I don't know why. It's like every time I watch this movie, it's like, oh, right, this movie isn't very good. Like every time I forget it's not very good.
It's because you remember, there's the same case with me where, like last time I watched it, the only thing I remembered was like kind of the charm of a bunch of aspects of it. And watching it again, it's like, oh, yeah, I don't even think I loved it last time, but I think it's fun. There's some fun moments, but overall, it's kind of forgettable.
Oh, and the one thing I do kind of enjoy, it's dumb, but I loved it, is the disarmament meeting where they're just playing Trivial Pursuit.
Okay, well, let's get into casting here. Trish, I know you're going to have a strong comedy cast. Why don't you start us off?
I do. And to start with, I'm just going to warn you that I binged all of WandaVision yesterday. It was great. I loved it.
So most of them are going to be in this?
There's a number of them, not all of them.
Okay, continue.
So actually, I did something fun here. When you have these two characters, they were kind of paired together in WandaVision for a while, and I love their dynamics. So for Milbarge, I actually went with Kat Dennings, because I just like watching around technology and just kind of pretending to be a physicist. So I thought, and her sarcasm sort of works in some of Dan Aykroyd's stuff. Like there's a whole moment where she's like, you're just thinking with your dick. And he's like, well, I mean, they could be following. He's like, maybe your dick isn't so dumb. I could see her saying that.
Mm-hmm. What can I actually?
Fitzhugh.
Yeah. I'm buying this like wholeheartedly right now.
Absolutely. And Fitzhugh, Randall Park, who when they're paired together in WandaVision, they're both very good. And I can see him being kind of charming, but kind of trying to be suave. And I really enjoy that idea. So I have those two. For Moyer, Dr. Moyer, is it Moyer? Yeah. For Donna Dixon's character, I have Boyer, I have Catherine Hahn because I think she would be just fun in that and she should be in everything. For Hadley, I went with Andrew Lincoln. I mean, he doesn't have a big part, but I mean, he's got to die and you've got to care about him. So I put him in there. General Sline, I went with Alec Baldwin because I just think that would be funny. And I know he could put in a couple of bits that would be very relevant today. General Miggs, Ed O'Neill. I think these two old guys, these two gruff old guys would be really great. Mr. Ruby, Bill Hader. I like the idea of, I think he would be very good in that role. And Mr. Keys is Ty Burrell. And that's everybody I sort of cast. I didn't cast anybody else. These were sort of the key people.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I went with too.
Yeah. And the director, I went with Paul Feig, who actually directed Spy.
Nice.
So
I could back that. I just realized I forgot to do my director, which happens often. But it I could back happen. That. I could back that with how good Spy was.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Jeff, why don't you give us your take?
All right. Well, I have one cast member bleed over, but with a completely different character as Trish. So I was thinking my Emmett Fitzhugh, the Chevy Chase character, be John Mulaney.
Nice.
He like thinks that he's going to be a great spy and maybe thinks that he's going to be like James Bond, but he's kind of short. He's like kind of skinny. And everyone's like, oh, that guy thinks he's James Bond. But also, you know, he's hilarious. And then his Austin Millbridge would be Bill Hader.
Totally see it. Totally see it.
And mostly, so both of them have worked together a lot on Documentary Now, which is hilarious. And they both wrote in Documentary Now. And Bill Hader, he's directed a bunch of episodes of Barry that he also stars in, which is excellent. So I would also think that Bill Hader would be a director on this movie, and him and John Mulaney would also both be writers on it. If Chevy Chase had been a writer on Spies Like Us, maybe it might have been a little better, if only because movies like that are usually better when people writing them are also two of the main characters. So they get to bring their own comedy into it.
And Bill Hader, I think he also has a bit more experience with action now after doing Barry.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, both of them are Saturday Night Live alums. So you're kind of playing into the spirit of the original Spies Like Us with both of them as well. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, apparently, you know, Chevy Chase, he's been to like rehab and he's been trying to turn his reputation around and stuff, even being older. So I thought it might be fun if Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd were both kind of in like the more government positions in this movie, who are sending off the new lackeys. Maybe not being the same characters, but it'd be a fun callback to the original one to have them kind of both in these more government positions. For the other spies who they're sending out, for the dude, I was thinking that why not throw in John Hamm as spy number one? Because he's great at playing those characters where he's supposed to be inhabiting a trope, but he's also turning it on its head. And he's kind of found himself typecast as that like suave 1960s guy, but with a comedic twist. But it's because he does it really well. For his female spy counterpart, I would want Gal Gadot,
nice,
who I think would be really good.
They already play a married couple who were spies?
In a movie with Zach Galifianakis and the other red-haired person who's not Amy Adams. But
Isla Fisher?
Yeah, Isla Fisher. And that movie has its moments. And I mean, they're both really good. And Gal Gadot and John Hamm both actually have pretty good comedic chops. I think for a villain, it's tough because depending on who we would or where we would have it placed in terms of the other country, I'm not sure who I would have as like your central foreign villain. But I do think it would be great if this movie was also peppered with cameos. Like you could throw in Tom Savini. You could throw in, you know, just tons of cool people who, you know, we know, like Jon Favreau, and just like faces and cool people who obviously have like worked in movies and love movies for a long time, because that's kind of the case with this one. And yeah, Bill Hader would direct it, I think, and it could be his directorial debut, and it'd be pretty fun.
Can I make a request on this
one? Oh, yeah.
I want Tom Savini to be Austin's like kind of mentor who taught him to like tinker and create things.
Oh, that'd be cool. I was thinking Tom Savini just because Ray Harryhausen is in it. And, you know, Ray Harryhausen's like this master of special effects from another era. I mean, Rick Baker is also that for special effects, but Tom Savini is like also a really great actor whenever he does decide to be a character in a movie. He has great screen presence.
Cool. All right, Sam, let's move on to you.
Okay. I cast pretty light as well. I only cast really five or six people plus a director. So for my Emmett Fitzhugh, I went with John Boyega. I thought he'd
nice.
He'd be sort of fun playing sort of the guy who wants to be a spy, and especially with his English accent, like he played off like it's really fake, even though it's really real.
Nice. I love it.
For my Austin Milburge, I cast Jack Quaid from The Boys.
Yes,
he kind of plays that kind of hapless smart guy really well. So I thought he'd be a lot of fun there. And they're both of an age, and I didn't want to go like into the like mid to late 30s like they were in this one. I figured younger agents were looking to sort of move forward in their careers was a good way to go.
Mm-hmm.
For my Karen Boyer, I cast Kristen Stewart because I thought she was really good in Charlie's Angels.
Mm-hmm.
I love the idea of her being sort of like really super competent in terms of like being smart and capable of like fighting off like an army of security guards kind of thing.
And she has that look where she's just not going to give you anything. Like she's got that very Sphinxian, I'm not going to give any secrets.
Yes, exactly. I didn't cast her partner, but I'm totally going to go with Jeff on this. And I think John Hamm really, yes, pardon the pun, but hamming up, being like a spy. I think that was a great fit because then they'd be like a really great mismatched pair too.
Mm-hmm.
You know what just occurred to me with the John Hamm being in this role, and we've got the guy, we got Fitzhugh who wants to be a super spy, but like John Hamm is a super suave guy that he wants to be, and he just hates him on sight.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I love that. So for, I only cast Mr. Ruby and Mr. Keys. I didn't cast any of the generals, but for my Mr. Ruby, I put in Jeremy Renner.
Good.
Because I think he could do skeevy really, really well. And then for Mr. Keys, the older of the sort of two corporate spy guys, I cast Dan Aykroyd because, again, he also does skeevy really, really well when he gets a chance.
Yeah.
For my director, I went with Rawson Marshall Thurber, who directed Central Intelligence and Dodgeball. So he's nice. Very good at comedy. He can go over the top like he did with Dodgeball, but he can also do sort of the spy comedy like he did with Central Intelligence.
Cool. All right. Well, let's move on to my cast. I'm going to stick with Trish's Paul Feig as my director because I didn't have one, so I'll steal hers. I'm still waiting for that sequel to Spy.
Right?
So for my casting, I think Trish will like a lot of this. For my Fitzhugh, I went with Andy Samberg.
Nice. Totally see it.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Yeah, I actually had my Fitzhugh and my Milburge really quickly. For Milbarge, good tinkerer who's made it kind of his shtick already. Richard Iowati.
Yes.
Itika. For my Boyer, I think I was on the similar thinking with Sam. I wanted somebody who looks really capable and could really be a kick-ass agent. Lupita Nyong'o.
Nice. Awesome.
Nice.
Yeah. For General Sline, I went with Michael Shannon because he makes an awesome villain.
Oh,
and
my God.
He would be a very commanding general, but at the same time, I think the comedy would really land there because he's so straight.
I can see.
Oh, yeah, he's also great. Really good in comedies, too. Like, mm-hmm. He's been in a lot of comedies, surprisingly, and he has great comedic chops. So.
Yeah, I think he'd be great. For Mr. Ruby, I went with Michael Kelly from House of Cards and Jack Ryan. He's kind of made a career out of playing political types, so kind of fit. For Mr. Keys, I went with Colm Feore.
Yes. Nice.
If anybody hasn't seen Bond Cop, Bad Cop, you should. It's on Netflix. And for Dr. Hadley, I felt it was important that we had somebody who, at least one person who's associated for actual spy movies. So, and somebody we would be happy to see die. So I went with Matt Damon.
Nice. And this is the kind of thing that he would do too, because he just has so much fun with it.
Oh my God, but you have to have a joke in there where Boyer's like, crap, like we always we came in and saved this guy like 10 times. I don't get what's going on. Finally, he's dead.
Yeah. No, I was, my cast came, like my first part of my cast came like right after I finished the movie. I'm like, oh, these guys. And then the next morning, I'm like, I had the other half. This was one of the fastest castings I've done.
I'm just angry I didn't think of Michael Shannon. That's why I'm curious.
I'm sorry. I'm
so angry.
I stole your director.
You did, but I'm like, I'm angry at myself that I didn't think of Michael Shannon.
You know, initially when I was going through casting, basically this would have been a movie that if it was made 10 or 15 years ago as a remake, would have been the perfect vehicle for Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly, directed by Adam McKay.
Mm-hmm.
And but they're just a little bit too old now for like that type of movie. But like Step Brothers, Talladega Nights era, Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly would be perfect. And Adam McKay is such a good director, too.
Yeah, you're probably right. It probably would have been good pairing. But yeah, now you're kind of just stuck trying to put some people together you're hoping will have chemistry.
Bill Hader and John Mulaney have acted together pretty well, but not in anything that's like a big project. But they do have pretty good chemistry, and they were both like writers together on Weekend Update way back in the day with Seth Meyers.
I almost put Seth Meyers in this.
Nice.
You know, he's a much better writer than I think people give him credit for. Like, as an actor, he's so-so, but he's a really good comedic writer.
Mm-hmm.
We could put Seth Meyers in as the news guy.
Yes.
There you go.
Yeah.
Makes sense. For our filler. So.
If I got Andy Samberg in my movie, he's going to get Seth Meyers in there somehow.
Nice.
Oh, and I also wanted to have Fred Armisen in there somewhere. I don't know where, but maybe a couple characters. Who knows?
Ooh.
I was going to say, he could play a whole bunch of characters throughout. Like, he played like this French resistance guy, and then he could play like a Russian counter spy. I could totally buy
you
that.
You know what? You could it where it's like basically you're parodying Dr. Strangelove, and you just get him to play all the Peter Sellers characters from Dr. Strangelove, but in this movie.
Oh, and you could have he looks familiar to them all the time, but it's just a different clone.
Or it's the same guy, and he's playing characters for them.
Yeah, he's actually
an undercover spy the whole time.
Yeah.
Oh.
He's the counter spy. Like maybe somebody in the government actually has figured out what's going on, and they've sent him. So there's a third party in the mix that nobody else is aware of.
Nice.
All the spies are American.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, the corporation that knows they're getting screwed, send somebody.
Yeah, and that would be a great way to play around with the trope of having a comedic actor play multiple roles, and then at the very end, it's all the same person. I don't know if anyone's done that before. That's hilarious.
Fun. Can we put in a very quick MacGruber with Will Forte?
No.
I think that would be fun.
No. No MacGruber. Sorry.
Oh, MacGruber?
No MacGruber. Can't do
just
it.
Just him and Val Kilmer in the background?
No. Can't do it. Can't do it. I can only take that so far.
Nice. Well, you know what? We can still put in Will Forte as other spy characters. I think he could do it. He can play he can play different characters like he did on SNL.
We could throw him.
One thing I was kind of,
yeah,
like it would be cool to just reunite a bunch of SNL alum for a remake, just because of the Chevy Chase Dan Aykroyd connection with the first movie. All those people of like the 2000s era of Saturday Night Live have all gone on to just become really incredible comedians in their own right.
Mm-hmm.
Cool to use it as a project to reunite a bunch of them.
Yeah, you don't get those like post SNL launch movies anymore that launch careers. We haven't seen anything like that in a while.
Not since Bridesmaid, really.
No. So maybe now's the time. Try it again.
It's the other thing too. Like when I think like buddy movies, I mean, I think of The Rock and Kevin Hart, but it's not as like part of my vernacular for like a buddy duo. You know, like there's nobody iconic as a buddy duo.
Like you have Key and Peele, but they're both in their 40s, 50s. You have Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly. They're both in their 50s. You have Abby Johnson and Alana Glazier from Broad City, and they're younger, and they're really great. But those are the ones
Danny
I can think
Putty
of.
Danny Putty and Donald Glover is Troy and Abed. They're really good together.
Peg and Frost, but they're in their 50s.
Yeah.
If our fans can think of good pairings, please let us know on our social media, at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion of the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and invasiontheremake@gmail.com. If you want to email us your suggestions, your corrections, and your comments, please do. And if you got fan challenges, please send them our way. We're always willing to take a listen, and we'll let you know if we'll do it or not, but keep them an older movie pre-2000 when you recommend them, and please let us know where we can find them, and we will definitely consider them as a future remake episode. And go check out our store and our websites. Please recommend us to your friends and family, but when you go to the website, Sam, how do they find the website, first of all?
Just go online to invasionoftheremake.wixsite.com/podcast.
And over there, you can find a little button that'll take you to our store, our TeePublic store, where you can get all sorts of cool stuff like posters, mugs, t-shirts, PPE masks, totes, and so much more. Lots of cool designs there. And they frequently have sales, so just keep checking back. But just know that every dollar goes back to, well, most of it goes back to TeePublic, but what little is left over for us goes back into the production of the show. So if you like the show, wear a little something on your back and your front, or put a magnet on your fridge, or wear it on your face even. Yeah, that'd be cool too.
It's a great way to tell your friends about this show without having to tell them.
That's right. And they'll be like, why is that fish so angry? And that's a way you can tell them about the show, because you've got the angry fish shirt. Or you could be that person who was in that thing that one time. You know you want to be. So get yourself some cool swag at our TeePublic store, and you can get there through our website. All right. Well, that was Spies Like Us. If you got any other recommendations for kind of these SNL guys, we haven't really done an SNL movie before with these post-grads from SNL. So this was kind of fun. I guess we did Trading Places.
Ghostbusters are kind of.
Yeah.
With
I guess we have done a few.
But they aren't very often. And there haven't been any that were so blatantly SNL-ish. This one really is blatantly SNL-ish because of the sketchy feel of like how each scene is kind of like a different sketch rather than part of a cohesive story. So it does feel very much like an SNL film.
Yeah, I mean, it was like two steps away from being Amazon Women on the Moon.
Which I love.
Which is probably a reference nobody gets anymore. But if you don't, go look it up.
Also John Landis.
Also John Landis. Maybe that's why this has that kind of feel to it. Maybe it was intended to be like just sketches, but I don't know. With Amazon Women on the Moon, they were just so far apart that like, oh, this doesn't forward anything at all, but it's still kind of fun.
Yeah, they don't make sort of like short sketch comedy films like that anymore. I know they tried with Movie 42 or whatever it was, which I still haven't seen and never will.
I haven't seen it either.
I have no interest in seeing a scene with Hugh Jackman with balls on his neck. Sorry.
You know, some sketches are funny, and most of them are not.
But I've never been a big fan of the Farrelly brothers. I find them to be the lowest of lowbrow humor, typically.
Right. Well, we're going to get away from comedy next week. We got something a little more fear-inducing. So until then, I've been Jason.
I'm always Sam.
And she continues to be Trish.
And I always return as Jeff Omega.
And we are out of here.
Gentlemen, I think you both should realize the gravity of this moment. I have spent the last 2.5 years of my life preparing for this penetration. This afternoon, I buried my partner, Jerry Hadley, perhaps the finest, most dedicated GLG-20 in the history of the service. He is now forever entombed in a snowy grave, and it's not going to be for nothing. We are here today to guarantee the personal freedom of every American. And we should never forget the words of President John F. Kennedy, who said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country."
Will you marry me?